Yes, the motivation of this work, which was done with Prakash Lakimer and Andrew Steiner from Stony Brook, is to see what the consequences of this color-flavored locked superconductivity that Rajagopal spoke about in, during the meeting last week. I mean, people have been putting quark matter in neutron star for a long time, and always thought to have a very big effect. But now it looks like this new calculation are something that at least people who do it believe it. They think they can really calculate something. And there are several groups who use completely different techniques, but they all get the same results, basically. So I mean, that's possibly we can make a serious model of a neutron star with quark matter inside and see what it does. So remember, use this phase diagram, which should contain everything. Now that's a chemical potential here, means density, no, and temperature. So depending on how you arrange the mass of the quark up, down, and the mass of the strange, then you have different phase appearing here. So at low temperature, low density, you have normal hadronic matter for all possible combinations. Let's say the interesting case would be something like this, no, when the up and down quark have a small mass, and the strange quark has a mass much larger than this, no. So probably what happened is, so at low temperature and high density of this color flavor locked superconductivity where all quarks are paired. At lower density, you only have two color superconductivity, means that you cannot pair the strange quark with the up and down because they have two different, widely different momenta. No? To make pairs, you need the Fermi momenta to be basically the same. Well, the optimistic case would be when they all the same mass, but that may be not very realistic. No? Oh, but the crucial point is not really the mass, but it's really the Fermi momentum of the particle. No? So you have to make a star, make an equational state, build your star, and see what kind of Fermi momenta you have inside the star. So the star we build, we use this, what Glenn Denning did. For a long time, people thought that quark matter would be very difficult because you would have a sharp phase transition. Glenn Denning showed in 92 that if you have two independent chemical potential, then actually you would have a smooth transition, even if it's the first order. And then you get funny phases, no? So this is a slice of a neutron star. So when quark would start to appear, then it would have small droplets of quarks. Then you have like spaghetti, lasagna, and then Swiss cheese. And at very high density, you may have pure quark matter. So which of these phases appears really and how they are configured is very difficult because you have to look at the surface interface between the quark matter and the nuclear matter. No? So how big will be the drops and how thick will be the rod and how thick will be the lasagna layer? It's difficult to calculate. Basically, what is easier to calculate is what fraction the volume will be in quark matter and which fraction will be in the nuclear matter.
Oh, I'm sorry, did you say what the little H means down there in regions 2, 3, 4?
That would be hadron, no? Like if quark drops, then you have hadron drop within the quark matter. So this is a Swiss cheese and this is an inverted Swiss cheese.
But are these drops then of the same density as their surroundings?
No, the density are different.
So they will rain, in other words?
No, the density is different.
Just call.
Right. Yeah, I know. Well, but no, you have serious problem because of the composition stratification. No? But do they have the same density? I don't know.
If they don't, they will rain down or flow down.
Yeah, but then you have to go against the chemical potential gradient.
Right.
But for you,
it's
not an equilibrium. To use exact numbers for R. You have to calculate the critical density for each.
Yeah. This is just
it's a
cartoon. No, it's a cartoon, yeah.
But nobody calculated exact critical density during the last, certainly not Stony Brook.
No. Now it's crude models. What Glendening,
this is just to. So
this is illustrative, yeah. What Glendening says is not studying possibilities, but.
I still take the numbers to theory.
No.
Okay.
I'm going to say not studying reality, but potentialities.
This may happen. It's not the role in scale either. It's not the role in scale because it's almost
probably.
Density is very constant in the core.
Yeah. So in the model we build, we only have this part roughly. We never reach pure quark matter.
Is there any argument for why there should be growth?
Well, just if you include the surface energy, then for small amount of matter is more favorable to have something spherical, then a more bigger chunk of matter is better to have them some kind of ellipsoidal or like spaghetti. There's a very similar phase appearing between the crust and the core. When you go from the nuclei would be like the drops, and then they start to become elongated spherical, and you also would have a spaghetti and lasagna and Swiss cheese phase, a very narrow range of density. So basically the idea for building this, it's funny, I never thought to check at the density of the two phases are the same, no? But okay, we'll use a model for the hadron phase with and without hyperon, so we use mean field. I mean, it's a toy model, but you can change the parameters and make very different neutron stars and see what they would do if they would exist. For the quark, we use a simple bag model. Basically, it's a free gas of quark, and we just add the vacuum energy as a B constant we put into the model. And then we impose chemical equilibrium between all particles depending on the reaction that can transform one particle into the other. You have different equations for the chemical equilibrium. And the point of what was made by Glendening that before people were assuming that you must have charge neutrality both in the quark matter and in the nuclear matter. But if you have this mixed phase, actually you don't have to have charge neutrality everywhere. You can have an average charge neutrality. So you may assume that the quark matter has some charge and the hadronic matter has a different charge. But the hadron fills only a fraction f of the volume, the quark a fraction 1 minus f. So it's both the hadron plus the quark must give you charge neutrality, but not each of them separately. No? And then we fix the baryon number. No? So with this, in principle, you take a simple model for everything, and you can calculate and get all the properties of the neutron star. Now, if you want to see if there's a way to recognize such a neutron star, well, the obvious first thing is to calculate the mass and see what the maximum mass you can get. And of course, you get the natural result. This would be for our model with only nucleons. Here we had the hyperons, and in these two cases, we had quark matter. This is the value of the bag constant we put in the quark matter. No? So you see, obviously, the more different kind of particle you have in the star, the lower is the maximum mass you can have. So that could be something useful.
Danny, can I just ask you, what is a hyperon?
Hyperon, okay, I'll describe them in a few minutes. No? It's just a heavier neutron or proton. The problem with this is that to really see if you have quark, you should be able to make a star like this, measure its maximum mass, and then put the quark in. No? We cannot yet do it in laboratory, so it's difficult once you have a really maximum mass to know does this have quarks or not inside. If you find 2.5 solar mass for the maximum mass in between binaries, then it would be a hard time for the quarks to make it. No? But if it turned out to be 1.8 or 1.9 solar mass, it would be very difficult to tell the difference. No? Another way is the maximum rotational frequency, no? Or the minimum period. So if you detect the millisecond, sub-millisecond pulsar, that also gives some constraints. No? And the cooling is another way you could tell the difference. No? So I was going to show you the few basic ideas to understand what's going to happen and what's not going to happen. Let me take, maybe I'll just describe briefly the various neutrino processes that you've already heard many times. There would be two very big different scenarios. No? Well, in the crust, I don't care too much. It's very little mass, not very efficient. No? What's going to be important is what's happening in the core. So basically, the important neutrino processes are just beta decays and inverse beta decays in various flavors possible. And the key point is this famous direct Urca process. That's a very simple thing, just to be able to have this direct Urca, which is a beta decay and inverse beta decay, you must satisfy energy and momentum conservation. So energy conservation is trivial if the matter is in beta equilibrium, because energy of the particle is a chemical potential. In chemical equilibrium, they match. The problem is just the momentum conservation. And since the momentum of a particle goes like the cubic root of its density, if you have very big difference between the proton electron density and the neutron density, then there is no way you can make a small triangle with the same momenta for these particles and close it. If you have much more neutron, then this momentum is too big and you cannot close with it. If you have enough protons and electrons, then you can close it, and then this process is allowed. So just being able to close or not to close a triangle will completely change everything in the life of the star. Because if you can do that, what do you do? I mean, energy is not the problem, but you have to take somebody else in this game, which are going to take or give you the momentum you need. So you have plenty of particles around, so you can add another, you can add another neutron here, which is not going to decay, but it's going just to take or give the momentum required. Or you can also add another proton, which is going to give you the momentum. But that becomes much less efficient, because the more particle you have, the less probable is the reaction. Let me just show you the order of magnitude of the neutrino emission from these. So that's typical modified Urca process, so that's what I say, no? It's a beta decay with a spectator neutron, which just gives you the momentum. And then if you can close the triangle, then you have the direct Urca. If you have quarks, you may also have a direct Urca. If you have a kaon or pion condensate, you can think something maybe like the condensate can give you, contribute and decay also, no? So you don't have the same restrictions. But the important things to see between them is first the temperature dependence. This one goes like T to the 8, while all these go like T to the 6. When the temperature drops, it will still be very efficient. This one is going to drop very fast. And then the number in front of it is very different. No? And it's simply due to the fact you have two more nucleons there, so that reduces efficiency. So basically, that's the two things. No? We have something which goes slowly, and everything else goes very fast. So how will it go? So let's do a very simple estimate of the cooling of the star. Just energy conservation, no? That's internal energy derivative with respect to time. Can write it in terms of the specific heat that is given. The energy is lost either in neutrino or in photon. The specific heat for degenerate matter is proportional to the temperature. The neutrino emission is proportional to the temperature to some power, n equal 6 or 8. And the photon emission is the fourth power of the surface temperature, which would be like almost the square of the core temperature. So C turn out to have this kind of value. And so I can easily solve this equation. First, I say, OK, I drop the photon and look when neutrino emission strongly dominates. And if I plug the value, I have this here. For direct Urca, then this constant will be like 10 to 27. For modified Urca, then it's going to be much smaller. No? I mean, it's straightforward to solve this. Solution is this. You plug the number and you ask, if I start with any very high temperature, how long does it take to reach like 10 to the 9 Kelvin? And with the direct Urca, it turns out to be 25 seconds. So that's not realistic. You should put 45 seconds. Makes no difference. No? So when the star is very hot, the neutrino cannot escape. But when they escape, it starts cooling. It's instantaneous. No? And if you have the modified Urca process, then it takes much more time. It's on the next transparency. No, that's the kaon condensate, which is like a direct Urca, but less efficient. Still very fast, 7 hours. No? It's so fast basically because it goes like T to the 6. So when the temperature drops, the neutrino emissivity does not drop too much. Well, if I go to the modified Urca, now that I have it, it was down there. The modified rocket to do the same, to reach 10 to 9 Kelvin, it takes 6 months. Now if I want to reach 10 to the 8 Kelvin, because actually the neutron star we see are like 1 million Kelvin at the surface, it's something roughly like 10 to the 8 Kelvin inside. So let's push this down into 10 to the 8 Kelvin instead of 10 to the 9. And here you get a very big difference. With the direct Urca, it takes 3 days to reach 10 to the 8 Kelvin. With the modified Urca, something like 500,000 years. So in some sense, this would reasonably explain the kind of surface temperature we see with these neutron stars of the order 100,000 years. They have something like 10 to the 6 Kelvin at the surface. It kind of fits. This obviously doesn't work too well, and of course, after a few thousand of years, the star will be completely frozen. So this is a way to tell the difference in principle between one scenario or the other, no? But of course, this is very naive if you accept that the neutron or the proton or the hyperon or the quark can be superfluid. It's going to strongly affect everything, no? The basic idea is once it becomes superfluid or superconductor, you get a gap in the spectrum. So a neutron cannot just decay simply because it has to go. The final energy must be above the gap. So if the temperature is below the gap, you don't have enough thermal energy to put a particle up there. No? Another way to see it is just, if the neutron is in a Cooper pair, first you must break the pair, then it can decay. And breaking the pair costs you also a gap energy. No? So in both cases, you get an exponential factor, a Boltzmann factor. And this can have a dramatic effect. No? Well, maybe I'll jump and show you the effect. It's something which has been known for a long time, and Sachiko and Herko talk with results about this, many of them, but just for again illustrating it.
We're also going to hear a lot from Dimitri next week. So
Dimitri?
Beckerle.
Are you talking about that? Okay. I'll go shortly.
No, you should show a little bit.
Yeah. No, so this will be a fast cooling. With different gaps. So that's what you expect if you have no superfluidity, no superfluidity. So just direct Urca going freely. And then I put some gaps. I have them. This is a proton gap I'm using. Okay. So the curve 0, ABC, up here correspond to 3 different assumptions about the size of the gap. The gap is roughly PC, no? The gap is related to the critical temperature. It's roughly 1.76 times the critical temperature. So once you reach this temperature, then you start building this gap and you start suppressing the neutron emission. But I'm going to tell you why we can take any value we want, show you that nobody can calculate it. So we take several values which are very different. The smallest one is 0.1 MeV, so it's 1.75 MeV, so the critical temperature is 10 to the 9 Kelvin. That's A, no? B, we take 3 times 10 to the 9 Kelvin, which gives you a gap of 0.4 MeV. And C, we take, should be 10 to the 10, here, 10 to the 10 Kelvin.
You so are not including Cooper pairs?
Yes, it is included. I'll show the effect after. So I have a quite small gap, an average one and a big one, no? And the small one has a small effect, the average has a larger effect, the big one has a big effect. So you can really see the result here, no? Depending, because the effect of the gap happened very early, no? When the star was just a few minutes old, or a few seconds old. So the temperature drop, it reads the trigger temperature, neutrino emission turns off. Not immediately, but rapidly suppressed. And then it stops cooling. You know? So you get cooling curves which are relatively fast, relatively flat. Later, when it's old enough, then photon cooling from the surface takes over and the temperature drops. No? But in all this early phase, it's dominated by neutrino emission. And here, for example, you see different. The slope is much steeper here because I have zero gap, so I do have neutrino emissions. Here I have a gap, so I have almost no neutrino emission left. So they're almost flat.
What are those data points?
Excuse me?
What are the data points? Are they data points? Those little bars?
Yeah, this I have. That's the data.
Which data?
Okay. Because this is the Vela pulsar, this is with Gaminga. What is PKS 107, 1207? And
but the ages are over all
about 10 to the 3 years old, yeah.
Danny, the ages are all spin down age?
Yeah, all the ages are spin down age, yeah. Yeah, in my last transparency, I have the labels here, so we can discuss who are these people, no? But I just want to show the general trend so you can even guess before doing the calculation what you will get. So let me show you why we take very different gaps. I try to not to screw up everything. This is the best calculation of the gap to date. It's a paper on Schmidt-Rev 98 by Baldo, Lombardo, Jensen, and Kvik, and Elgaroy. So they consider different models for the nucleon-nucleon interaction, which are the best one to date, no? V18 from argon, the bond potential, and two versions of this Nijmegen. So they take different models, the best model to date for the nucleon-nucleon interaction. They use exactly the same technique to calculate the gap, and that's what they get, completely different results. With one model, you get something relatively small, no? 0.2 MeV, that means critical temperature is a maximum 10 to the 9 Kelvin, and then it doesn't go to very high density. And this one just skyrockets and doesn't give any indication it's going to stop. I mean, that was amazing, because people have been publishing many of these calculations. No, not many, but several of these calculations in the past, and they would get totally different results. So you would say, okay, I mean, somebody's wrong, somebody doesn't know what to do, doesn't know how to do the calculation. And the people show now, I mean, you hope they don't know what they do, so I've done a lot of work on that. So there's chance interaction, and of course you get completely different results. And why? Because this is mostly due to the triplet E2. So you have to look how all this model for the nucleon-nucleon interaction reproduce the data from scattering.
Is this for quarks or neutrons?
No, this is neutron.
Neutrons,
yeah. Purely neutron, yeah. No, quark would just pick up any big values. So this is what you could, these are really the data, no? Either in terms of the laboratory energy for neutron-neutron scattering, the phase shifts, it's the way nucleophysicists extract some value from the data, no? So it tells you how strong is the interaction. So a positive phase shift means interaction in this triplet P2 channel, in this partial wave, specific partial wave in which the nucleons are colliding. While this delta is positive, meaning it is attractive, once the delta becomes negative, then the interaction is repulsive. And this is what is, this gray line is what's come from the data. No? So when you reach energy of about 1 GeV, then the interaction becomes repulsive. Below this, it is strongly attractive.
I'm sorry, which is the data?
The gray line.
The gray line is the data.
And these are the theoretical calculations for this particular channel using different models. And you see they all do pretty well up to about 300 MeV. Then they go completely wild.
Then you count this gray line being used indirectly.
Yes, exactly. You can use it in some way. And it would give you a gap of obviously, which will be very large and go to Fermi momentum of the order of 3.5. But that's a lousy calculation. But it's better than using the real model. I mean, either you use a lousy model, but the data, or you use a better model and lousy potential. No? So in one way, there's no way to do it. And it's hopeless. It's, I mean, desperating, because These calculations have taken, I don't know, 20, 30 years of work to get this model. And they can't go higher than this.
But can you comment on the applicability of scattering in vacuum to the interaction in a dense medium?
Yeah, you have to start with this, no? And then you have to build all the theory. So the point of these people
I guess what I'm asking is, why would you even say that? Why would you even say you'd start with this?
Well, first you need to know the interaction between two neutrons, or neutrons and proton. You would like to know it in the medium, you don't. So you start in a vacuum. So, okay, neutron interacts with the neutron with this matter. Now I put it in dense matter, and yet you include all the effects of the interaction of the neutron with one neutron and with all the other ones. And I hope you can do it.
Danny, can you explain why there's such a large discrepancy between the characteristic energy here, like 400 MeV for the center of this attracting well, and the gap and energies which were like 1 MeV in the slide you showed us before?
That's the energy of the particle colliding, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kinetic energy.
This is the phase shift of a partial wave expansion. So imagine you're doing scattering of particles. Right, you can just define the scattering in this as the shift in the partial wave. So it's a small scattering angle, which probably right.
That's a phase shift, no?
The phase shift.
In the wave scattered is a little bit bigger, has a phase which is slightly larger than if you want to go through without scattering, no?
Right, but it's still like 10 degrees, okay? 10 degrees, so let's say 10% of 300. Even if characteristic energy is only 10% of the 300 or 400 MeV, that's still way bigger than the gap energy that you showed on the previous slide.
Can I do this so simple? The way I see it. Okay, if I have a potential, it's very small potential, and my wave coming here, if it goes through, it goes through, no? No interaction. If it goes into the potential, then once you go to the potential, then the frequency increases, no? So you would see that when it comes out, then it is a little bit ahead of that one. So that's a phase shift, no? When going through the potential.
How deep is the potential in this case?
But no, we would have to estimate the width of this, a few fermis, and see how much the phase is going to shift in this partial wave. I don't know. There's probably a simple formula which you can find in the textbook, I hope. But I don't know.
There's probably some sine squared or delta in this.
Yeah, there's some.
It's not 10%, it's 1%.
It's a sine squared.
The delta depends on width. Yeah. If you climate chart, you will have a unique relationship with delta. Just that
short. Okay, so the result of this is that we cannot take, I mean, on face any calculation of the critical temperature. But we can reasonably assume from this that we can have large gap to high densities. But as you said, going from the interaction of a free neutron against a free neutron into a neutron, pair of neutron in a medium, it's completely different. So the medium may change completely the situation.
Well, of course, there is some evidence in media, which would be in a Fermi liquid theory with where one is attempting to connect the parameters to certain experiments on large nuclei, like
which indicate,
giant resonance of both kinds. Mm-hmm. And presumably they have their own estimates of gaps. I don't think they're very different, but
That would
be avoiding the worst aspect of Laura's question. Not that I'm contesting what you said about not being able to do it very accurately, mm-hmm. but also to put it in perspective, this gap that Doug Scalapino has spent all his time calculating for high T superconductivity comes in a system with repulsive thermally liquid parameter. And the potential is repulsive on the average, but on the other hand, you do a Fourier transform of this thing and it turns attractive at some point way out here in space, and even that is making superconductivity. Mm-hmm. So
it's a Hodgkin, yeah.
It's very Hodgkin.
It's a Hodgkin. I think the other conclusion of this paper and these people was that there is no point now to do very sophisticated many-body theory if the potential can give you anything. No? If you don't know the interaction, there is no point to do. And so it looks unfortunately we have to live with this for a long time. So that's why we're basically taking very, very different, widely different gaps and see what are the effects. No? So I'm going to put this. Where am I going? How long is it supposed to be? 45 minutes?
1 hour? Oh, we should try to end by 1 because it's a talk at 2 o'clock.
Okay.
I think people will want to walk on the beach for an hour.
Yeah. So, there's a question about hyperon. Just let me mention a little bit this because a few very naive things you can do to argue why we would have hyperons. So here's basically what hyperons would be, no? It's lambda and the triplet of sigma, and you have a bunch of them with higher masses. So they're roughly like neutrons and protons, but a little bit heavier. If you look at the way they build with quark, the naive quark model, the neutron would be an up and two downs, while, for example, a lambda would be up and down and then strange. And the S quark also has the same electric charge as the down, but it's heavier. So when you replace the down quark by an S, you still get a neutron particle, but it's at a heavier mass. So it's just heavier nucleons. And I want to see if I can have them there. You can use the mean field model that I'm going to use, but it's still a toy model. So I'll try to get a rough idea of, really, is there a chance to have them doing a simple estimate. So this you get it by looking, as always, at the chemical potential. No? So look at all possible reactions to produce a lambda. For example, you can imagine the proton plus an electron will give a lambda and the neutrino leaves. So the chemical potential of the neutrino, you can put it equal to zero. So you would find that the chemical potential of the lambda is the chemical potential of the proton plus the chemical potential of the electron. No? Which give, and the chemical potential of the proton plus electron is the chemical potential of the neutron, because you have the same reaction with a neutron instead of a lambda. No? So to see if you can have a lambda, you just have to calculate the chemical potential of the neutron and get an estimate or a model of what would be the chemical potential of the lambda in matter. But this should be like the mass of the lambda plus or minus some energy which comes from the interaction. No? So it's the mass of the lambda plus or minus 50 MeV or something. Like this, reasonable. Unless there's strong repulsion, then it could be the mass of the lambda plus 200 MeV, but most probably it's not too far from the mass of the lambda. No? And you do the same with all of them. So you get all these conditions. So when you look in the model of nuclear matter and you go to a higher density, well, the chemical potential of everybody basically is going to grow. So the chemical potential neutron will grow, and you may hope to get the value close to somewhere around the mass of the lambda. No? This one is a little bit better because you want to get roughly to the mass of the sigma minus. It's a little bit heavier than the lambda, but then you must use the chemical potential of the neutron plus the electron. So that grows much faster. No? So I'm going to take a model of nuclear matter which does not have hyperons and just calculate this chemical potential and see at which density they reach roughly the mass of the lambda. So here for the neutron. No? So I have four different equations of state. This is a Friedman-Pandari-Pandey. This was an improved version from Weidinger-Fix and Fabrocini from 86 or 88. There's a new version now, but I haven't done the calculation with the most modern equation of state. So these are the best microscopic calculation, no? Which start with this kind of potential that people use also for the pairing, and they do hold the many-body theory to get the energy density of matter. No? And these are calculations of Malfit and Ritter, Prakash, and Edgeworth. So you use simple theory, but which is a relativistic framework. No? So these are like state-of-the-art calculation. So I calculate the neutron potential, the chemical potential as a function of the baryon density. This would be nuclear matter density, 2, 3, 4 times nuclear matter density, and see for each model at its own prediction. And I draw a line at the mass of the lambda, and I go roughly get a range of density between 2 and 3 times nuclear matter density. But I may expect that maybe the hyperon will come. But that's very low density, no? Not very high. Of course, if the interaction of the lambda is strongly repulsive, then the mass, then the chemical potential of the lambda could be observed, and then you push it to high density. No? This is hard to estimate. But if I have this equation of state without hyperon, I can also calculate neutron star with this, calculate the mass of neutron star and see what mass I get at these densities. So let me do it exactly. So I can report here the densities at which it is happening. I calculate my neutron star. So I keep that one with the critical density. Here the mass of the neutron star as a function of the radius for the same equation of state. And I plot the line here. So for example, this one was both for Terhammar-Fitton and MPA, which are this curve, they cross around here, which about 1.2 solar mass. But if I take this one, Freeman-Pandari-Pandi, then I see that they cross at somewhere which is even below one solar mass. No? So even a relatively low mass neutron star has very high chemical potential, which indicate that maybe we would have hyperon there. No? And if I do the same for the sigma minus, and I can do exactly the same result, calculate the chemical potential, they go much steeper than the other one because this is chemical potential of neutron plus the electron. No? And I put again my line on it. I look where they cross the chemical potential of the sigma and I put this on the curve here, and of course I get much lower mass. Like Freeman-Pandari-Pandi, guarantees about 0.6 solar mass. So at very low mass, I really have huge chemical potential and I may have hyperons. It doesn't prove I have hyperons because I don't know really what's the interaction I have to plug in. But that is actually, I think, a good argument that we really have to consider it seriously, and we should put the hyperons into the models. What's funny, let me see, you say, well, this mean field theory are really toy model, but if I compare the critical mass I found from this equation of state, which I would say the serious microscopic equation of state, and the critical neutron star mass I get to get the sigma minus or the lambda, and then they compare with Glendening's model of mean field theory and his critical mass to get the hyperons, and I find that this theory is very pessimistic.
WFL.
That's William Gaffix Fabrocini. That's Freeman-Pandari-Pandi. It's very similar, no?
What's pessimistic and optimistic in this context?
Excuse me?
What's pessimistic and optimistic in this context?
Oh, I mean, I get very low mass here to have hyperons. So, I mean, it's optimistic, no?
You want hyperons.
Yes, hyperons are good.
Yes. Hyperons are good. Well, you could say they're very bad.
I've lost the sign now with all these changes. you're getting hyperons at very low density.
Yeah, I get large chemical potential, no?
Okay.
Which make it reasonable to have hyperons.
That's what's bad. Pessimistic.
Oh, it's bad. Yeah. Oh, you
I would say this one.
Glendening, I've been pushing for 15 years that there are hyperons everywhere, yeah. And using mean field theory. And I say it's pessimistic in this sense, that he's a pessimist in the sense that if you do this, you get even more hyperons that you get. But of course, this is kind of phony because...
That's fatal for our modes, I suppose, but that goes back to the other conference. I suppose it's just fatal for...
What is
the point? Because of the non-atomic two-body bulk viscosity. Because you can do sigma plus, it's, what's his name? Name's point? Because you can do neutron plus neutron goes to sigma minus plus proton, or lambda plus neutron, and it's slow. It's weak. It's weak, but it's not. But it's fewer bodies, so it's bigger than other weak processes. On my time. Well, not on my time. It doesn't matter for neutrino cooling, though.
That contributes to shear viscosity?
Bulk viscosity.
It's much faster, you think?
It just means you squish this stuff down, the hypercharge equilibration proceeds faster than it would have than any other weak interaction. And since the weak interactions are a little bit slow to match millisecond periods, that increases the damping by quite a lot, by enormously. That's a 1967 paper by Jones, amazingly, which we've been ignoring here in the hopes that it will go away.
Okay, so that was the motivation to put hyperons and then quarks. So we have, I'm going to show you the results. So that was a specific model I show you here. I mean, the most interesting look at the bottom one, the chemical composition. Here, okay. So again, in terms of baryon density, so here 0.16 is nuclear matter density. This is 10 times nuclear matter density. So this is really the range relevant for making neutron stars. So at low density, we have enormous amount of neutron, a little bit of proton and electron, the muon come into the game. And at relatively low density, the model, we have the sigma minus appearing. A bit higher density, we have the lambda. In most of these models, the sigma minus appear before the lambda just because the chemical potential is more favorable. But you can also change a little bit the model, and you can get the lambda appearing before the sigma minus. So you shouldn't believe anything which depends crucially on exactly what's happening. You just have to see the general trends of the model. But you see that very soon the relative population of each of these hyperons when they appear grows a lot. And you really have a star which is full of all of this matter. Just 20, 30, what, even up to 50% of the matter is actually lambda and sigma minus. And people then have put K on condensate and pi on condensate to get it becomes horrendous. No? But many complicated things can happen. No? Then we put the quarks using the typical technique. So we have this simple bag model for the quark matter. And we just equilibrate the chemical potential and impose charge conservation on large scale, not microscopic charge conservation. So we can estimate with the model what's the amount, how many quark we have. No? So we see in this particular model, we have quark appearing roughly as this density. Here, the quark. No? So first I have the sigma minus coming in. Yes, I have the lambda, and just a little bit above the lambda of the quark coming into the game. No?
You calculated this critical density. It's critical density where the quark appears. So
yeah.
Who calculated it?
Andrew Steiner did calculation and did it on my side. But it's exactly the same model of Glendening has been proposed in 92, the same technique. And this one in particular, I can give you a reference.
Okay, Iwamoto got very different. Iwamoto got very different.
Yeah, you even with this model, you change the parameters and you get something completely different.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know. We don't know.
Very hand-waving. Yeah, if it tackles
exactly
there, it's very
but saying it doesn't happen is also hand-waving. Just wave hand like this for one. So you cannot exclude them. It would make life easier to exclude them, but I don't know. At least I don't think we can do it. So let me show the result if I find it. I'm sure I brought the results. Yeah, here it is. So this would be standard cooling. So here we use what is the best microscopic equation. Just neutrons, a little bit of proton, no hyperon, no quark, no condensate, no nothing. That's really the prototype of the standard cooling, and that's the most recent calculation of Akmal, Bandari-Pandi, again on Ravenhall. It's 1.4 solar mass, and we assume that the upper layer of the neutron star are made of iron. And then I take the same gaps that I had showed before, now A, B, and C. We made a critical temperature of 10 to the 9 Kelvin, 3 times 10 to the 9 and 10 to the 10 Kelvin. So I only have the slow modified Orca process and the neutron prot, one proton Bremsstrahlung process, and I have the Cooper pairs. So when I heat this here, I start suppressing strong neutron emission, but I have a bunch of neutrinos being emitted by the Cooper pairs. And in this continuous curve, then I have no gap at all. So you see that the gap has some effect, but not tremendous. The small gap has a bigger effect just because of the Cooper pair emission. It happened pretty late. Actually, the star is still in a regime here when you have substantial neutron emission by the Cooper pairs. And this even the lowest beta. This is Vela pulsar. You can fit it with the Cooper pair. Now let me go to the one I already showed you before. So that's the basic stuff, and I'm going to put more and more curves in this until you're completely confused. Okay, so that's our model. So we take this model for the interaction, and we take only neutrons and protons and nothing else. No hyperon, no quark. Zero gap, EC 10 to the 9, 3 times 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10.
This is quark cooling?
No, this is only neutrons and protons, but with a direct Orca. Okay, yeah, in this equation of state, we do have a direct Orca. And I change the gap. Again, when people say that all this fast neutrino cooling are ruled out, it's completely wrong, because this gap is pretty large. But if you use uncertainty on the calculation of the gap, or you just use a measured triplet P2 phase shift and estimate the gap, you get very large gap. So this is quite reasonable to have high values of DC, which can reach 10 to the 10 Kelvin, and you can get this kind of stuff, even if you have fast neutron emission. It's even too high, no? Because Vela would be.
So then in the first 10 years,
yeah.
So the reason does not change because the cooling from...
Exactly. Yeah, all this calculation that solve completely for the transporter feet in the star.
Neutrino is still cooling in the core, but
exactly.
Does not reach the surface.
Yeah, that's what it's doing here. So it stays hot at the surface
because
for about 10 years.
Reach the surface, yeah.
Exactly. And then the cold wave hits the surface and the temperature drops. And how long this is going to last depends basically on how thick is the crust. If you have a very thick crust, then it lasts a bit longer.
So could you extrapolate to an even earlier phase?
Yes.
Say 20 seconds.
Uh-huh.
10 to the 6 Kelvin, right?
The surface. I always start to plot here because of the initial condition I use. So I see it takes about 1 month for the surface temperature to relax from the initial condition.
1 month.
And 1 year for the full profile in the star to relax. I start with 10 to the 10 Kelvin or 10 to the 11, 10 to the 12. After 1 month, I see that whatever initial condition I put very hot, the star is down around there, the surface temperature. Thanks to neutron emission, about 1 month, I get the same temperature for whatever initial hot profile. And to get the full profile in the star to relax for a minute, initial condition, it takes about a year. So that's why I like to start plotting it here, no? Before it depends what you
routine. Then, sorry, this is direct ERCA when paired neutrons.
Direct ERCA with paired neutrons, yes.
If the protons are not paired, but the neutrons are, there's a proton branch that's fast, isn't there?
A proton?
A proton branch to the direct ERCA that's...
Both are involved, no? Yeah, the difference that protons are not expected to be paired in the core of the star at high density. What is the pairing temperature is probably very low.
So if that's the case, it's so, a proton range contribution to the director, but it's fast.
No, but the director can involve neutron and proton. No? The neutron goes into a proton. So you can stop it saying, okay, the neutron is paired or the proton is paired. But it seems like the critical temperature for proton would be much, much lower than for neutron. So that's the dominant process. But if you put proton, you just change the name, but you get the same curve, no? Almost the same curve. Now let me put the quark. So it's the same model, but I allow quarks to be into the game.
Which emissivity do you use?
That's Iwamoto's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the problem is Iwamoto's calculation shows that the pressure density is too high. So what will not happen?
Yeah, but the calculation of the luminosity has nothing to do, or the emissivity has nothing to do with...
Yeah, the same person calculated the cost. And last month he said the pressure density is too high.
But because they were still doing it the wrong way, that people need it for the phase transition with all the mixed phase.
The same emissivity. You are using the same emissivity.
But the cap is microscopic calculation. Just assume we have up, down, and strange quark. The critical density for the phase. Yeah, because we assume that you have a sharp transition from nuclear matter to quark matter. You didn't have the bubble, the spaghetti, the lasagna. That makes a big difference. If you don't have this, then it's very high density. If you bring this...
You have a reference for exact calculation for density. I want to see.
Yeah, I can give you the... Yeah. So these are all model with quark matter, but no pairing, no? So that seems to be completely unrealistic because the gap, the quark must be very big. And you see the effect. So for each gap for the neutron, A, B, and C, I do the same and put the quark on top of it. So I have zero gap for the neutron and zero gap for the quarks. I get the same results. The quark make no difference because the neutron emission of the quark is less efficient than from the direct ERCA by about an order of magnitude. So the cooling is driven by the neutron proton direct ERCA, not by the quark. Now, if I start suppressing the emission from the nucleon with a small gap, and then I put quark matter, even in this case, it doesn't make much a difference. And the curve is even a little bit higher simply because the quark take away some volume in the star. So the what's driving the cooling is still, in this case, the nucleon direct ERCA, but in a smaller volume because part of it is filled with quarks. And then if I take a bigger gap, then the neutron emission is strongly suppressed, and then the quarks start making a difference. Then the neutron emission from the quark is more efficient. So. And if I take an even bigger gap, of course, makes no difference because the quark drives the cooling. They don't care about the gap in the neutron.
So the dotted ones are quarks?
The dotted. Oh. The dotted one are with quark, and the continuous one are
the one,
no quark. Yeah.
Direct
the direct ERCA, yes. It's exactly the same curve as I had here, no? Putting them in the same curve, but then I have the quarks. Then I accept the gap for quarks. So I take also very big gap and very small one. And then the quark makes basically no difference. And then you can expect. So the gap I have A, B, C, D can shoot. Well, A is a small one, which is 0.1 MeV, B is 1 MeV, C is 10 MeV, and D is 100 MeV. So what people claim is rather like C and D, no? Enormous gap. So I have, again, the four curves I had before with no quarks, and then for each of one, I put the quarks, and I put different gaps. So I see if I have the only case when I can't really tell difference between different quark gap is here, it's simply because if it's a small quark gap and a large neutron gap, this is critical temperature of 10 to the 10 Kelvin, so it really suppresses strongly the neutron emission in nuclear matter. Only have the quark which can contribute, they make a little bit difference. No? But it's still much smaller than uncertainty in the data. No? So you need a very small gap for the quark to make see a difference. And here they're absolutely identical. I can a gap from 0.1 MeV to 100 MeV makes no difference. And here it's even worse, it's even worse. You look at, I mean, from this there's very little almost prospect to tell the difference if you have on or do not have quark. The only possibility would have to have zero gap, then you would see something like this. No? But if we believe this data, these are really temperature of the surface due to the cooling and not something else, then this is ruled out. No? Now I promise you to confuse you completely, so that's the last one. What? You're probably already. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. To show that it can. So this is with quark, nucleon quark, and hyperons. Huh? And in this case, what do I have? So the dotted one are with quark, and the continuous one, quark and hyperons, and nucleon and protons, and the continuous one do not have quark. Then you have for a full range of masses, all the previous one are the same mass. So if I put quark, the maximum mass is 1.48 solar mass. If I don't have quark, I can push it a little bit higher. So I have two different curves which correspond to masses that I cannot have with the quarks. No? But in the masses that I can have with quark or without quark, if I put the quark in the dotted curve, but then put the quark in the dashed curve, it's exactly the same thing. And the idea is just...
The director has the hyperons?
The hyperons also, the director K is suppressed. Either by the neutron gap.
In your direct model, you have hyperons, not just neutrons.
In this one, yeah, the previous one, no.
Now
I have hyperons, okay. And I have hyperons pairing them. And why it makes nothing in simple is the gap is 100 MeV. It's suppressed by e to the minus delta over t. And T, any reasonable temperature, is a fraction of an MeV. So the exponential of minus 100 to minus 1,000 is zero. So specific, it is zero, the neutron emission is zero, and you don't see it. Hard to see quarks. That's the conclusion, no? So the pairing is extremely important, but almost everything you can do with quark matter, you can do it with another model, which are also maybe weird, but not weirder than having quarks. And if quarks are really big gaps, then there is no way you can see them on the cooling. It's as if it were not there. And then if you want to be really optimistic, then you can say, okay, with good data, we can make constraints on the gap. But we don't know whose gap it is. No? It is the lambda, it's the neutron. So we need something else to get definitive conclusion. I can stop.
You said you need something else. What else?
Submillisecond pulsar, 2.2 solar mass neutron star, or something like this, no? And the mass and the radius, of course. No? Getting that would help.
Well, I mean,
everything, neutrinos from a galactic supernova, it would help also.
Well, what is needed is more microscopic calculations. For instance, Kanagawa really calculated the gap for the concentration of protons so that direct nuclear takes place for nucleons. It's too low. And nobody calculated for hyperons. So I'm sure he will calculate the gap for hyperons with the proton concentration so high so that the direct nuclear takes place. And whether he will get a small supercooling gap as for nucleons. So things like that can still help.
Yes, but I would say just give a tendency,
not just observation, but the microscopic calculations.
But we still don't know the nucleon-nucleon interaction at high density.
Yeah.
So Akatsuki-Tamagaki calculations show that if you have a high proton fraction, then the gap is strongly suppressed. Yeah. That's true, but you don't know what it is, it's not suppressed. It's so huge that it's still reasonable.
Last week, Roger Gopal had in addition to the phases you showed on your first transparency, you had the possibility of, sorry to bring up another possibility, of crystalline quark matter. Does that have implications for cooling?
I have no idea.
Danny, can I just ask you a simple question about the neutron, the neutron material and the neutron gap? If the neutron gap, if the gap in the neutron material is 1 MeV, then can I assume from that that the pairing energy, the characteristic pairing energy for the neutrons, is also of order 1 MeV?
It's 1 MeV, yeah.
Okay. In that case, why is it that that is 100 times less than the characteristic interaction energy of two neutrons which you're scattering? You know, at closest approach when you're scattering two neutrons off each other in those experiments, the characteristic depth of the well is 300 MeV. Mm-hmm. So why is...
Well, 300 MeV was kinetic energy, no?
I understand, that's not, but that's roughly...
That's not the depth of the well.
I understand that,
not the
but
well.
It's
no, you
avoided.
So
it's
still the same. Slow down. So the depth of the potential well is about 30 MeV.
That's right, because the scattering
so
was 10 degrees. So why is 30 so much bigger than 1?
Okay.
That's it. It's a simple answer, but I know it's going to help, no? But the gap is roughly of the order of 1/2 times the Fermi energy. And then this is a disaster. That's from BCS theory. It goes like an exponential 1 over V, V being the, well, so, and some factor, V being the pairing potential. So the gap, the size of the gap is determined by the Fermi energy, which is hundreds of MeV, no? And then you have to estimate this pairing potential, which means you need a neutron-neutron interaction, which you don't know. You have to take into account the bond media effect. You don't know. And then once you do all these things, very difficult to calculate, you put it in an exponential. And then there is a factor which depends on the effective mass, and that's what Tamagaki and Takatsuka estimated that if you are direct to Uka, this factor is very small, so the gap is smaller.
Okay.
Well, you might look at that another way and say the history of making these potentials after all has been hit. Fit scattering data and light nuclear binding energies, and they've always been very bad at hitting those light nuclei. You know, they fit scattering perfectly, and they miss the deuterium and tritium by, again, temperatures of order and MeV. And what that just tells you is that it's just terribly non-unique understanding how nucleons bind in terms of looking at a whole batch of scattering phase shifts. You can spend your life fitting those phase shifts and still not get the binding right without putting it in ad hoc the way Fonder probably still does.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't forget, you know, where the deuteron binding energy is 2.2 MeV.
Say that again.
The deuteron binding energy is 2.2 MeV.
Okay.
Well, they always got that bound in those calculations, but then tritium wouldn't be bound, you know. Anyway, it was just terrible. It still is terrible.
Benny, what is the shear viscosity of the quark matter?
If it is superfluid, then it's zero. No? Superconducting. But it's enormous.
About the same as.
Probably.
Shell is about the same as the nucleus.
Did you say the apocryphal is peak next week?
Yes, indeed.
Well,
it's even true.
I wonder if you can postpone to another week, not only for my behalf, but Thomson, Duncan, they will all be aware, and I'm sure they want to hear him too, and I have to be aware next week.
You're going to talk about this offline.
I have to be in Montana, so I beg you.
You're going to beg, okay.
Well,
you
want to hear him next week, and three of us have to be aware.
Okay, let's thank Danny.